Though there be the stars in my crown, I am thinking today of the beautiful land I shall reach when the sun goeth down. And through wonderful grace by my Savior I stand, will there be any stars in my crown? Will there be any stars in my crown? When at evening the sun goeth down, when I wake with the blessing of mountains of red, will there be any stars in my crown? And the strength of the young, let me labor and pray, let me watch as a winner of souls, that the last stars may be mine in the glorious day, when his praise like the sea billows roll. Will there be any stars in my crown? When the evening the sun goeth down, wake with the blessing of mansions of rest, will there be any stars in my crown? Oh, what joy it will be when his face I behold, living gems at his feet to lay down. He was sweet and my bliss in a city of gold. Should there be any stars in my crown? Will there be any stars in my crown? When at evening the sun goeth down, when I wake with the bliss in the mountains of light, will there be any stars in my crown? Judgment and Harvest, Part 6. We're going to continue now our theories on this Judgment and the Harvest, Tract 3 by the V.T. Hartog. And we're on page 81. And as the wave sheaf and the wave loads are typical, then also the Feast of the Tabernacles must be typical. Otherwise, the ceremony would not have been observed as part of the harvest rite. And as in the type, the feast was to be celebrated at the close of the final end gathering of the year's harvest, then correspondingly, in the antitype, it must be celebrated at the close of the final end gathering of the earth's harvest, which is nearing its fulfillment. Well, I'd like to say one thing. This tract was written back in 1934, and if V.T. Hartog perceived that this prophecy was meeting its fulfillment back then, how much more so now with over 80 years later? All right, so this is where we're at, folks. So the time consumed in the producing and in the offering of the wave sheaf and the wave load, also in the observing of the Feast of the Tabernacles, is representative of the entire spiritual harvest time of the living and of the dead. Bearing out this fact that the spirit of the prophecy said, the Feast of the Tabernacles is not only commemorative but typical. So now, the Feast of the Tabernacles were not only typical, but commemorative, meaning that they're binding today. If it means commemorative, why would we commemorate any day today that was established 3,000-4,000 years ago? Why would we commemorate it? Because it's still binding today. Why would you celebrate something that had no historical meaning to it? Okay, let's go on. It says that, bearing out the fact that the spirit of the prophecy said, for the Feast of Tabernacles was not only commemorative, but typical. Now this is Ellen G. White talking. She's saying that the Feast of Tabernacles was typical, and we're in the Feast of Tabernacles. The Feast of Tabernacles ends next Wednesday on the 11th of October. And that's a holy day. Next Wednesday is a holy day. It's a Sabbath day. Okay? And so now it says, for it's celebrated the ingathering of the fruits of the earth and pointing forward unto the great day of the final ingathering when the Yeshua, the harvest, shall send forth his reapers to gather the tares together in bundles for the fire and to gather the wheat into his garner. At that time the wicked will all be destroyed. Patriarchs and Prophets, page 541. So here's Ellen G. White talking again. Plainly therefore, since the first and the second fruits of the literal harvest, and its attendant rites foreshadowed a spiritual harvest of the first and second fruits, they ought to be climaxed by the antitypical feast of the tabernacles. Isn't this amazing how Ellen G. White, raised up in 1844, she died in 1915, but her works and the words that she put down by the inspiration in writing lives on today, and it will live on clear into eternity. Because we quote her writings today as authoritative as any other spirit of prophecy writings that there are, whether they be in her books, Sweet Jehovah's books, The Shepherd's Rod, or whether they be in the Bible. Now all your Bible prophecies in the Bible are titled spirits of, they're all written in the spirit of the prophecy great book. This whole biblical book of ours, this Bible, represents the whole spirit of prophecy from Genesis to Revelation. People don't realize, they say, those 10 little red books by Ellen G. White is called the spirit of prophecy. Revelation 19:10 talks about John the Revelator. What he saw was the spirit of the prophecy. And then you go back all the way to Genesis. Spirit of the prophecy is in all the prophecies that the prophets recorded. So if you don't have inspiration, what does it say? 2 Peter 1:19 say? It says that you have also a more sure word of prophecy that you do well to take heed, as unto a light that shines in a dark place until the day dawn, and the day star arises in your heart. And Yahshua is the day star. And it says you have a more sure word of prophecy. You need to seek to understand all the prophecies that's ever been recorded. And you can only do that by inspiration. Okay. For thus, ancient Israel's dwelling in the booths typifies modern Israel eventually dwelling in the woods. Now this is, I don't agree with this statement, but V.T. Hollis is trying to coordinate with Ellen G. White about the fact that in the last days the saints are going to have to leave the cities and they're going to have to dwell in the woods. And in the outer way places and in caves and all that kind of stuff. Well, I don't accept that. Now that prophecy has unfolded in these last days as to how it really is going to be, the saints are going to be in charge of this world in the same time, not the wicked. The wicked has no spirit with them. They have no inspiration. So why would Yahweh use them to usurp their authority over the righteous that have received the outpouring of the Holy Spirit in their life? Nothing doing. This is Satan's trick. And the prophets, starting with Ellen G. White, did not understand this aright. And I'm not saying anything against Ellen G. White, for she's my favorite prophetess. I mean, her writings are invaluable. You know, we can't live without them. But I'm just saying, yes, she said, even though my writings have been accepted as the truth, they must be taken to the law and the testimony. Can I accept this If they cannot pass this test, there's no light in them. Okay. Here, irrefutably, therefore, the harvest of Matthew 13 precedes the close of probation, and it is in the time of the end gathering of the first and second fruits, the 144,000 and the great multitude, all the saints who are to be translated. As the light focusing unto this point clearly revealed, that the Pentecost after the resurrection was for the end gathering of those who were to die, there must correspondingly be a Pentecost for the end gathering of those who are to be translated, and by the same token of the logic, the wave sheaf and the wave loaves must have a double application, each unto the dead and unto the living, together comprising the total fruits of the antitypical harvest. For the apostolic Pentecost and the providing of the power for the end gathering of the second fruits up until the beginning of the judgment of those who are now dead, foretoken the final Pentecost, which is yet future, and which is to bring the power for the end gathering of the second fruits of the living, those who shall never die. In other words, those who died prior unto the final Pentecost are to be judged by the light of the truth reflected through the power of the apostolic Pentecost. From his baptism unto his ascension, for the Yahshua taught abroad of the truth that was for the preparing of those who accepted of the truth, for the imparting of the truth. Then on the day of the Pentecost, he condemned, he endued them with the Spirit to proclaim it with the power. All right, and we're on page 83 of a little tract, The Judgment of the Harvest. We're approaching the last paragraph. It says, concerning the judgment, the harvest, the servants of the Yahweh declared. I then saw the third angel, said my cunning angel, fearful is his work, awful is his mission. He is the angel that is to select the wheat from the tares. Did you know that there's an angel that is designated just for one job, and that is to come down here and separate the wheat from the tares? Does anybody know his name? No, I don't really know his name. But he could very well have a name like Gabriel. You know, he could very well have one. But he has a name, and he's a real angel. And he's pointed out in Scriptures. Because for the Adventists, they have five angels with messages for the bringing forth a purified section of the Adventist Church, and that's five angels found in Revelation 14. Verse 14 through the rest of that chapter. And there's five angels listed all together, starting with Revelation 14, 6, the first angel. And the last angel is mentioned in Revelation 14, 17, the fifth angel. So from Revelation 14, 6 through 17, you have five angels' messages. And Ellen G. White said these five angels belong to the Adventist Church. All right. Sister White said it. All right, let's go on. It says, I then saw the third angel, said, my coming angel, faithful, fearful is his work, awful is his mission. He is the angel that is the select of wheat from the tares. And seal or bind the wheat for the heavenly garner. So, Brother Johnson taught the five angels' messages. Ellen G. White said that she saw this third angel, that he was the one that was to select the wheat from the tares and seal or bind the wheat for the heavenly garner. Well, when that third angel's message is through, well, then the fourth and the fifth angel has to come in there and succeed him and take and carry on the work from the third angel. So if that third angel is to select the wheat, it says to select the wheat from the tares, that would then be during the judgment of the living and the 12th parabolic hour that we're in now. The wheat would be the 144,000. The tares would be those that didn't believe the three angels' messages to begin with. Not the five angels, but the three angels. So Adventists says, oh, we're three angels people. We're sanctuary people. Oh, we believe those three angels. This says that third one, awesome is it, awful is his mission. So that third one, they say, fearful is his work, awful is his mission. It shouldn't say awful is his mission. It should have said awesome is his mission. That's your better word. Okay. He is the angel that is the selected wheat from the tares and a seal or bind the wheat for the heavenly garner. Early Romans, page 118. Now I've got a question here. Now Sister White, she's lauding this third angel as having an awesome mission. But according to Revelation 14, he flies in the midst of heaven. His feet never touches the earth, the third angel. So how in the world is a third angel going to come down here and bind the wheat here on earth from the tares and gather them into that heavenly garner? The Bible plainly says in Revelation 14 that the third angel's mission is one thing, to warn the people that they don't go back and take the mark of the beast. And he sends that message from heaven. He didn't come down to earth and give that message. He gave it from heaven. The first, second, and third angels, they fly in the midst of heaven. They never touch the earth. They never come down to this earth. But that fourth and fifth angel comes to this earth, Ellen G. White saw. She said they succeed the three angels in heaven. They come to this earth to carry out the work that the three angels had prophesied. So, the one that Sister White should have said, I then saw the third angel. She should have said, I then saw the fourth angel. She should have said, I then saw the fourth and fifth angel. I said, my accompanying angel. Fearful is his work. So Sister White said, my accompanying angel. She said, that third angel. I saw the third angel. I said, my accompanying angel. Fearful is his work. No, she didn't see the third angel. She saw the third angel in 1844. But she didn't see that third angel in the end time. She only saw him in 1844. Because if that third angel had a message to select the wheat from the tares, which the wheat represents 144,000, then she would have said that third angel appears here in the end time, and this is his message. If you're going to say an angel has got a message, and he's going to come with that awesome message, well then you've got to know that message has to be unfolded and revealed sometime or another as to what it is. How would the wheat represented by the 144,000 know what to accept if that message hadn't been opened up and revealed what it is? So Sister White, she just said the third angel has a message, but she don't tell what the message is. She don't tell where it's recorded. The only record we have of the third angel is found right there in Revelation 14:11. And it's just one little short sentence. Says well, let's go read it. In Revelation 14, verse 9 to 11, it talks about the third angel. This is the only place in the Bible that talks about the third angel. And yet Adventists made 160 years worth of prophesying about that third angel's message. But they didn't have a clue what the third angel's message was. They just said, we got a third angel's message that is to be heralded to all the world for 160 years. They never told what that message was. So what were they teaching to all the world for 160 years then? I'm going to read it to you. And the third angel, Revelation 14:9, followed them, saying with a loud voice, if any man worship the beast and his image, and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of Yahweh, which is poured out without mixture, into the cup of his indignation. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. Okay, what are we talking about? The three angels' messages. And here's what Ellen G. White told those Adventists back there when she got the third angel in 1844. She says, and the third angel followed what? The first two angels. Let's just read the first two angels. And verse 6, and I saw another angel fly in the midst of this, Revelation 14, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, and unto every nation, and kindred, and tongue, and people. Now, what's the deal on that? This angel was flying in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth. So now here's an angel, first angel. He's flying in the midst of heaven. He had the everlasting gospel to preach to those that dwell down here on the earth. Mm-hmm. But how is it going to get here to the earth? By the Spirit. Because the first angel was not allowed to come down to this earth. So the only way that he could get the gospel here would be by the Spirit, the medium of the Spirit. Mm-hmm. All right? So he said, but that message, the first angel, was having the everlasting gospel. This is about the only place in the Bible that links those two words together, everlasting gospel. And that first angel, that Ellen G. White, the first angel belonged to William Miller. Didn't even belong to Ellen G. White. And the Adventist. They belong to William Miller. The second angel belonged to William Miller. Only the third angel belonged to Ellen G. White. And William Miller is called First Day Adventist because they linked up with the Seventh Day Adventist and the parable of Matthew 20, verse 5. They were called sixth and ninth hour laborers working together. So Miller Rice was a sixth hour laborer and Ellen G. White was a ninth hour laborer. They were connected together with three angels' messages. William Miller had the first two. So the Seventh-day Adventist only has the third angel. And what did that third angel tell them? So it said that first angel, though, says, sends a loud voice, fear Yahweh and give glory unto him, for the hour of his judgment is come. And worship him that made heaven and earth and the sea, and the fountains of waters. And there followed another angel saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city. So I'm in Revelation 14:8, and it says, Babylon is fallen, that great city. So that's your second angel's message. And then the third angel was, verse 9, and followed them, if any man worship the beast and his image, and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand. Okay, I want to ask you something, Betty. Where did the Adventists come out of?
Where did they come out of?
They come out of the Dark Ages, mm-hmm. with the Protestant movements, out of the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church is represented by the beast. So the third angel's message says, don't go back and worship the beast and his image. In other words, don't go back and pick up where the Dark Ages left off of worshiping the Pope and the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. So don't go back there and take that number. and worship that beast. So she's telling us now, you've come a long ways. You've come out of the Dark Ages. They ended in 1798. You've been about 46 years now removed from the Dark Ages. You now have got the 2300-day prophecy and the light of it unfolding and lighting on your pathway. Now follow that light of the sanctuary that's unfolding on your pathway. Don't go back and take the mark of the beast. And what happened? The Adventists by 1888, by the General Conference leadership, which was led by the Jesuits as a figure, was a Jesuit General Conference president that infiltrated the Adventist Church. And so what happened? They got 90% of the Adventists to reject Jones and Wagner's message of righteousness by faith in 1888. Sister White held up Jones and Wagner's hand and said, "These men have additional light to what I've already brought. Receive their message." And she says, "And you will be in the kingdom in 2 years." Okay. So, third angel's message, then don't go back and take and worship that beast. Don't go back into the Catholic Church and worship him. Because that beast time period has come to an end. He is now represented by another kind of beast. And that's a leopard-like beast of Revelation 13. So don't go back and take that the worship of that beast. So what did the Adventists do? 90% of them rejected Jones and Wagner and Ellen G. White in 1890 General Conference at Minneapolis. And they accepted the Jesuits, Catholic leadership of the General Conference of Seventh Day, they accepted them. And so what happened? Fulfilled the dream that Ellen G. White had about there in Volume 1 of the Testimonies, page 578, I believe, where she said she saw a Catholic procession come around her house and said that with a reed and something, said this, these goods are confiscated. So she saw that vision in a dream, she said. The Catholic Church, she said, men that she knew well, that was members of the Adventist Church, she said, they had Catholic garb on, and they were marching around her house saying, all these goods are prescribed. We're confiscating all of these goods. So the Adventist, then 90% of them chose to go back and worship the beast. By 1890, then take them about 45 years to retreat back into Egypt and to worship the beast. Okay. So, but there was a remnant that escaped in 1890. And they had a 40-year fast, and then they went and joined V.T. Hotta and the Davidian movement in 1930. Let us continue on now with our study on page 84 of Judgment and the Harvest, a little track. It says that, "Now therefore be ye not mockers, lest your hands be made strong. For I have heard from the Yahweh Elohim of the host a consumption, even determined upon the whole earth. Give ye ear and hear my voice, hearken and hear my speech." Isaiah 28:22-23. "And now that each one who honestly seeks to hear and to heed the voice of the truth may have the clearest possible grasp of the several aspects of the subject of the judgment, the harvest, they are hereat brought into the consolidated focus. For the reader will remember that those who arose with Yahshua on the 18th day of the first month, followed the chart on page 65, were immortalized and received into the heaven as the antitypical sheaf pointing to the end gathering of the first fruits that shall never die. Their resurrection from the dead signified the beginning of the first fruits harvest of the 120 disciples
who were to die and be resurrected. The fact that the followers of Yahshua were not of the one accord before the resurrection is very positive testimony that the first fruits, the 120 of them that slept, did not ripen, become fully converted until after the resurrection. Now, folks, this is deep deep information here that we haven't necessarily seen before. I'm seeing some new things here. For the 40 days of Yahshua's personal presence on the earth after his resurrection was the time in which the first fruits were gathered in. For after his ascension, the Christians, or the believers of the Nazarene Creed, closeted themselves in the upper room and did not emerge to preach the truth until the day of Pentecost and after. For the 120 who received the power of the Spirit on the first day, the wave loaves were offered, were therefore the antitypical wave loaves, signifying the completeness of the first fruits harvest. Subsequently came the second fruits of the dead, and the period of which the tares were commingled with the wheat. Wonderful indeed is the way in which Yahweh has worked out the plan of salvation and revealed it step by step as necessary. When in 1844 the investigative judgment of the dead and the end gathering of the first fruits of the living began, he did not leave his people in the darkness concerning these events. I have something to offer here. If the investigative of the judgment for the dead began in 1844, and it was ongoing for the next 158 years until 2002, which it was, well then, what was the cleansing of the sanctuary for in 1844? It was all of those who had their names retained in the Lamb's Book of Life from Adam clear down to 1844. Otherwise, you can't have a cleansing of the sanctuary. You can only have a cleansing of the sanctuary of past records, not future records. Never a cleansing for future sins that have never been committed or investigated. It's always for the sins that were past. Always go backwards when you start investigating and making an atonement and retaining names and getting rid of names. The Day of Atonement is the day when that happens. So in 1844, we had a cleansing of the sanctuary. Cleansing of the sanctuary from what? All of those records that had been kept from the Garden of Eden cleared down to 1844. And all those folks were dead. All those folks were dead that was in that book that was being investigated. Now, then if the judgment of the dead then continued on from 1844 until 2002, well then, what were they investigating? They were reviewing the records of those that have already been judged in 1844. The investigative judgment today is a review of the records that had already been made from Adam down to the cross and up to the day of 1844. Because those records had already been investigated and completed in the record books. And so all that was going on now since 1844 is a review of those records of all of those that had their sins blotted out in 1844. That's all it is. And it took 158 years for that to happen, from 1844 to 2002. Because that's when the judgment of the dead closed out at the end of the 11th parabolic hour with Rollis Johnson as the angel of the seventh candlestick, Laodicea, prophet to the Adventist Church, the last prophet to the Adventist Church during the judgment of the dead period. So now, why are we told then that the saints are going to investigate the records of their brethren and all the wicked that didn't make it? They're going to have 1,000 years to go back and review those records and investigate to make sure that somebody wasn't misjudged along the way. All right, it said, the very first vision which Sister White received in 1844 was of the 144,000 first fruits, the servants of our Yahweh, who shall never taste death. See early writings, page 13 to 15. Just as Yahshua and those whom he raised and took with him became the prototypical sheaf and betokening the end giving of the first fruits, the 120, of those who are to be resurrected, so also when he entered upon his priestly ministration in the first department of the heavenly sanctuary and presented himself and his trophies before his Father, they became the antitypical sheaf betokening the ingathering of the first fruits of those who are to be translated, the 144,000 living saints. In the light of this parallel, the spiritual condition of the 120 before the apostolic Pentecost is clearly seen to typify the spiritual condition of the 144,000 before the future Pentecost. For the 40 days, Acts 1, 3, and 9, from the resurrection unto the ascension, are consequently typical of the period from 1844 unto the fulfillment of the marking and slaying as recorded in Ezekiel 9 and Revelation 7, 3 to 8, Revelation 14, 1 to 5, respectively. And in the Testimonies unto the Ministers, page 445. Testimony, volume 3, page 266. Also, early writings, page 270-273. After the first fruits are sealed and the tares are removed from among them, they then being separate from the influence of the world, as were the 120 on the day of the Pentecost, will receive the outpouring of the Holy Spirit in as much greater measure as the increase of the wickedness demands a full and more decided call unto repentance. Testimony, volume 7, page 33. The first fruits of the dead, 120, being a numbered company, and the second fruits of the dead, the multitudes, gathered after the Pentecost, being an unnumbered company, so correspondingly must it be with the first and second fruits of the living, hence the seeding of the 144,000 first fruits, and hence after this, says John, I beheld, and lo, a great multitude, which no man should number, of all the nations and kindreds and people and tongues, stood before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with the white robes and palms in their hand. And all the angels stood round about the throne, and about the elders and the four beasts, Revelation 7, 9, and 11. Mark carefully that this great multitude stood before the throne, not bodily, but figuratively only as viewed in the early writing, page 55, and as is evidenced by the twofold fact that, number one, the angels stood around about the throne and about the elders and the four beasts, showing that the great multitude was outside of the angelic circle, and that, number two, the presence of the angels, the elders, and the four beasts about the throne shows that the judgment, Revelation 4, 2 and to 6, was still in session, and that therefore probation had not closed. For the palms in the hands of the great multitude, Revelation 7, 9, 11, and the victor's palm placed in every hand of the outnumbered host of the redeemed, the Great Controversy, page 646, betokened two entirely different events. For the latter received both a victor's palm and a shining harp. whereas the former had no heart but only palm. Clearly then, while the palms and the hearts of the redeemed host in heaven are actual guerdons of the victory, the palms of the great multitude on earth are figurative victory palms. Now we see that by the testimony of the prophets, by the parable, and by the ceremonial type, Yahweh has wrought the towering structure of that of, number one, the judgment is the harvest, the separation of the tares from the wheat, the end of the world, that number two, the judgment, the harvest embraces two phases, two periods, the former for the dead, the latter for the living. That number three, the one takes place according to the records in the books in the heavenly sanctuary, whereas the other takes place simultaneously in the church on earth and in the books in the heaven. And that number four, the very fact that the subject is now being revealed in its fullness testifies that we are just on the verge of passing out of the former and into the latter phase and period, and that we are therefore living in the last days of the earth's history. This fourfold view of the judgment, the harvest, thus exalts the truth of it as a pearl of the great price and reveals that the depths of the Elohim's words are unfathomable, its wisdom inscrutable and infinite, without beginning and without end, its fund of the knowledge a perpetual fountain of the truth, its presence ever abiding, and its beauty ineffable. Now that the reader may be strengthened to hold fast to this fundamental and all-important truth, as well as to all other truths, we urge him to follow Elohim's method, inspiration in the studying of the scriptures, that he may thereby avoid many snares. Okay. Perhaps foremost among the multitudes who are snared while doing all they can to run away from the inspired interpretation of the scriptures are the extremists, of whom there are at least two classes, one with the tendency to literalize, the other with the tendency to spiritualize. Take, for example, the Revelation statement, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of the Yahweh. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Yahweh, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood? Revelation 6, 9, and 10. The literalist, on the one hand, would interpret this scripture to mean that the souls were conscious and actually crying out through the Bible and very...
Though
the Bible is very explicit that the dead know not anything. Exodus 9:5.
Ecclesiastes
9:5. And two, were the souls under the altar literally crying out for the vengeance on their murderers? Then to be consistent, the Yahweh statement, the voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground, Genesis 4:10, also the statement, all the trees of the field shall clap their hands, Isaiah 55:12, likewise must be interpreted literally in spite of the fact that it is impossible physically for blood to cry out and for trees to clap their hands. If all, however, are obliged to admit that Abel's blood could not literally cry out, and that the trees can only figuratively clap hands, then again, to be consistent, a person given unto the extreme literalizing should easily take hold of the actuality that the dead know not anything, and that they are asleep unconscious. He ought easily, too, to perceive that the souls of the martyrs crying for vengeance on their murderers and that the blood of Abel crying for vengeance on his murderer are cases virtually identical in their circumstance and condition. Both of these find pointed illustration in the poetic utterance, "I hear a voice crying out, the voice of the withering field, O Yahweh, pity thou me. Let showers fall from heaven, quench thou my burning soul." For one's soul to be imprisoned consciously under something for hundreds of years, with nothing to do but groaningly to languish and waiting for the resurrection morning, the while crying out for vengeance on them that spill one's blood, what an inexpressibly unbearable state for one's soul to be in. For the doctrine, though, of the unconscious state of the dead not only puts at peace the word human mind, but also ascribes to Yahweh's mercy and love toward the helpless beings, thus being the only position on the subject that can lead the sinner rationally to love Elohim and to trust in him. Unto the one who, on the other hand, is inclined oppositely to spiritualize the souls, the slaughter, the heaven, the new earth, etc., to him these have neither individuality nor reality. And when concerning the doctrine of the slaughter, he is asked a simple question: what kind of slaughter would a spiritual one be? He is at a loss to answer. For all there exists in this connection one great need, the Spirit of the Truth, whose rod alone it is to interpret the Scriptures. The most common cause of the doctrinal confusion among Bible students lies in their so very frequently failing to view a subject in the full perspective from the writer's point of the view, a failing which results in their seeing it from some foreign standpoint, so narrowing their view that instead of gaining the writer's idea on the subject, they gain a false idea on it. And if the idea be unto their liking, they magnify and zealously promote it as the truth, whereas if it be not to their liking, they vigorously oppose it and then lay it to the responsibility of the writer. For the illustrator thus gave a wrong idea of things from a wrong view of it. Okay, we're going to skip that. We're getting close to the end of our study, actually. We have about 10 minutes, so we're going to skip over a little bit. Okay. Concretely, it is never fair when treating of the subject of the judgment. We're on page 94, last paragraph, of the judgment, to give first and foremost consideration unto any writing which deals directly with the subject of the salvation, while only incidentally referring to the subject of the judgment. Take, for example, Paul's statement, "Which hope we have as an anchor of the soul, both sure and steadfast, and which entereth into that within the veil, whether the forerunner is for us entered, even Yahshua made an high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek," Hebrews 6:19-20. Instead of hearing the content of these verses in the light of all that is revealed on the subject, a procedure which would ensure the verses reflecting the author's thought, some Bible students, losing sight of the Paul's point of the view, magnify out of all due proportion the importance of these verses' statement, thus placing upon it constructions which, though perhaps plausible enough when taken alone, are manifestly strained, warped, and untenable. when viewed in the light of all other scriptures bearing on the subject. Such wrestling, needless to say, is unfair unto the author. Perilous is the one affected and criminal of the wrestler. Well, illustrating the matter still further and more extensively surrounding a table are six Bible students and an infidel. On one side are Peter's, James, and John. On the other, we have black, brown, and green. While at the end is the infidel. Well, I'm not going to go into that. Mm-hmm. I'm going to just bring a track chapter, the Judgment and the Harvest track. I'm just going to bring it to a close right here. Because we dealt with the meat of it, and that was, at the end, was dealing with the five angels' messages. And I think to wrap it up, we need to go and read to the scriptures now about this fourth and fifth angel, which is found in Revelation chapter 14. Let's go read a little bit, if we have time, for about the five angels. It's found in Revelation 14.
Okay.
Revelation 14. Let's start with verse 1. And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on the mount of Sion, and with him 144,000 having his father's name written in their foreheads. Okay. And I heard a voice from the heaven as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of a great thunder. And I heard the voice of the harpers harping with their harps. And they sung as it were a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders, and no man could learn that song but the 144,000 that were redeemed from the earth. These are they that were not defiled with the women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto Yahweh and unto the Lamb. Now these virgins, they mean that they weren't defiled with false doctrines of other churches. In verse 5, Revelation 14. And in their mouth is found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of Yahweh. And that's here on earth, folks. This is during the harvest of the first fruits. This is just the beginning of the harvest of the living, and then the dead, the resurrection of the dead. This is just the beginning, folks. And we haven't even met the 144,000 yet to begin this great harvest of the earth. All right, the angelic messages. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, and unto every nation and kindred and tongue and people, saying with a loud voice, fear Yahweh and give glory unto him, for the hour of his judgment is come, and worship him that made the heaven and the earth and the sea and the fountains of waters. There followed another angel saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. And the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if any man worship the beast in his image, and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of Yahweh, which is poured out without mixture, into the cup of his indignation. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angel and in the presence of the Lamb. Now, folks, this is right here in this last parabolic 12th hour that we're in now. This is for the probationary time, yes. And it's going to be those that reject the truth and don't get the seal, don't learn this new song, they're going to be tormented day and night in the presence of the holy angel. Alright. They're going to be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angel. And the smoke of their torment ascendeth up forever and ever, and they have no rest day nor night, who worship the beast in his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name. So those that worship the beast as image receives the mark of his name have no rest day or night. Here is the patience of the saints. Here they keep the commandments of Yahweh and the faith of the Yahshua. Now, isn't this amazing? Remember I told you before about this word faith, that they left out the words that gives power to that word faith, and that's the blood. Let's read that again. Verse 12, here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of the Father, Yahweh, and the faith in the blood of the Yahshua. And that's Romans 3, 24 and 25. And I heard a voice from the heavens saying unto me, write, blessed are the dead that die and the Yahshua from henceforth, yea. No, actually, die and the Yahweh, the Father, from henceforth, yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors and their works to follow them. Verse 14, and I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and upon the cloud one sat like unto the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. And another angel came out of the temple. So now, who is this angel there in verse 14 and 15? This is the fourth angel, the L.G. White saw, that joined the third angel. And another angel came out of the temple, crying with a loud voice unto him that sat on the cloud, thrust in thy sickle and reap, for the time has come for thee to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. Earth in prophecy is the United States. So this is where the 144,000 are going to be gathered from, right here in the United States, to stand with the Lamb on Mount Zion in the land of Israel, in Jerusalem. So they're going to be translated into His kingdom here in the United States, going to be translated out of here into the land of Israel in the last days. Verse 16, and he that sat on the cloud thrust in his sickle on the earth, and the earth was reaped. And another angel came out of the temple which is in the heaven, he also having a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar. Now this is the fifth angel for the judgment of the living. Started in 2002 at Kermit, Texas. Which had power over fire. And what does fire represent? Represents the Holy Spirit. And cried with a loud cry unto him that had the sharp sickle, saying, thrust in that sharp sickle, and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. So the clusters of the vine of the earth are your Gentiles. They're harvested in the fall. And they're part of the second fruits harvest. Okay? The grapes represent the Gentiles. The wheat represents the house of Israel. And the angel thrust in his sickle into the earth, and gathered the vine of the earth, and cast it into the great winepress of the wrath of the Yahweh. All those that didn't get harvested in the first and second fruits, then you have an angel that comes in and he mops them up. He casts them into the great winepress of the wrath of Yahweh, and the winepress was trodden without the city, and blood came out of the winepress even unto the horses bridled by the space of 1,600 furlongs. This brings in, if I said this hour, you can contact us at the 11th hour call, and if not, 11 click on our audio archive. We're going to close now with a song. How beautiful heaven must be. We dwell in the places called heaven. It's made for the pure and the free. These truths in yours worthy are given. How beautiful heaven must be. How beautiful heaven must be. Sweet home of the happy and free. The haven of rest for the weary. How beautiful heaven must be. Dear water of laughter flowing, and all who will drink may be free. What a joy, a splendor of glory, how beautiful.
all heaven must be. A beautiful heaven must be. Sweet home of happy and free. Fair haven of rest for the weary. A beautiful heaven must be. The angels so sweetly are singing up there by the beautiful sea. Sweet chords from their gold harps are ringing. A beautiful heaven must be. A beautiful heaven must be. Sweet home of the happy and free. A haven of rest for the weary. A beautiful heaven must be.